Session number 5251.
Brigadier Anderson, tape 3. What rank did you hold when you were in Shanghai?
Captain.
And when did you finally leave Shanghai?
Well, we finally left Shanghai in November 1933 in HMT New Delhi en route for Bombay. We stopped on the way to Bombay, at Hong Kong, Singapore, and Colombo. And we were able to take the troops on sale to exercise at that time. Well, we got a wonderful send-off from Shanghai. The SVC, that's Shanghai Volunteer Corps, put a pipe band in front of us, and we marched past on the way to the quay to Miles Lamson, who was the High Commissioner at that time, now Lord Killern. Well, we arrived finally in Bombay in December early, and after a four-day journey up to Rawalpindi, the rest of 1934 was occupied in very intense mountain warfare, and it's just as well it did happen, because in 1935 the Mumal campaign broke out in the frontier, and in 1937 the Waziristan campaign broke out. However, I saw none of these for the simple reason that my time as adjutant expired in October 1934. I was posted home to the regimental depot at Stirling Castle, and got home just before Christmas in 34. As soon as I reported to the depot in the early part of 1935, I was informed that there was a vacancy for the as adjutant of the Hong Kong Volunteer Defence Force. Well, I immediately applied. I was interviewed by the Colonial Office, and as I knew so many people in Hong Kong already, and I knew most of the volunteers already, I was selected for the post, and I sailed again for Hong Kong in October 1935. And I arrived on a very most fortuitous day in Hong Kong, which happened to be St. Andrew's Night, 1935. And the Scottish Society of Hong Kong was staging their usual annual ball. Well, it happened to be a very happy event for me, for the simple reason, on the night of my arrival, I attended the ball. I got to know, meet again, many old friends, but the most important of all is I got to meet many of the officers with whom I was going to serve in the next 3 years. Now, when I arrived in Hong Kong, the composition of the corps was roughly this. There were four companies, one English, one Scottish, one Eurasian, and one Portuguese. And there was enough personnel to man a battery in one of the forts in Hong Kong. There was an armored car section, there was a mounted infantry troop, there was an air element, there were engineers, and there was a fairly large medical section, which was useful. Also, we had a very large headquarters, which included an officer's mess, a sergeant's mess, a quartermaster's stores, a large drill hall, a parade ground, a miniature range, and a canteen. I also had an ex-regular officer as a quartermaster and an ex-regular soldier from the Harbour Board as an RSM, the Regimental Sergeant Major.
What sort of standard was the equipment you had? Was it mostly up to date?
Well, I didn't expect very much. But, I got a lot of keenness, but I didn't get, you might say, a tremendous amount of knowledge. but they were very keen and they were very anxious to learn.
You mentioned that you had a couple of aeroplanes. What sort of vintage were the aeroplanes?
So ancient, I wouldn't like to say.
Yes.
I remember the Field Marshal Tedder of the Second World War. He was a wing commander then. He came up to visit me, and he had a look round, and he said, this is the kind of thing we want, and we want all the volunteer parties in the country to organise the same kind of thing. He was very helpful.
And also you mentioned that you had a couple of armoured cars. What sort of...
Yes, we had an armoured car section. Now, in the event of war, they were really designated as a China Command Reserve. We couldn't use them, I'll tell you why later, because what we had to man was no use for armoured cars, so they became the reserve for the headquarters of China Command. Now, during my years in Hong Kong, I had to make quite a number of speeches, and there's one subject that came up in every single one of them, and that was recruiting. Now, recruiting for the Eurasian and Portuguese sections, companies, were no trouble at all. But recruiting for the British element was difficult. In fact, it became almost impossible in the end.
Why was that?
I'll tell you in a minute. I think a lot of it was due to the apathy of the British population in not only in Hong Kong, but in all places in the Far East. And also to the fact that you could never instill into them that there was any possible chance of war. Now, I spoke to a lot of these fellows and suggested they should join. And they said, don't you worry, we'll join as soon as the balloon goes up, so there's no need to worry. I said, but I have need to worry for the simple reason, if you join when the balloon goes up, then you embarrass us tremendously. If that happens in that way, all the regular forces of the colony will be in the war stations. The volunteers will either be there on the way out. You will roll up in the hundreds at headquarters. We'll have no one to instruct you. You don't know how to use your arms. We can clothe you, we can arm you, but you won't know how to use them. And you'll be a tremendous embarrassment. I pointed out it would be so much easier if you join now, get a little elementary training, and so they would know what weapons they could use when they joined. But absolutely no avail. I was very strongly backed up by the governor in that. In every speech he made, he said the same thing.
Right. Did the governor think there was a distinct threat of war?
He would never say that, but he obviously wanted to be prepared. Exactly the same way as headquarters China Command. They would never come out in the open with it.
What other steps did you take to induce people to join the volunteers, apart from speech-making?
Well, we ran weekend camps, which were very popular. We had evening sessions for training, and which we got regular instructors from the units of the garrison to instruct them. And they were very good instructors. We always got the units gave us always their best. And they all loved the annual combined operation with the Royal Navy and the rest of the garrison, which took place once a year. Now, as regards to training, this was a difficulty. We always had an evening session 5:30 to 7 when we had regular instructors. We had weekend camps when we got regular instructors, and we had the combined operations when we were on our own. But we were very much in the hands of, and we very much had to rely on the goodwill of the bosses, as you might say, or the taipans, so called in Hong Kong, like the banks, the great big shipping companies, the harbour board, the public works department, the big firms in Hong Kong. We had to rely on them to release their people, men for training, on the nights they were due to train. I must say they cooperated pretty well with us. There were one or two occasions, of course, which it couldn't be done, but generally speaking, we've got very good cooperation with them.
Did you advertise in the press at all for volunteers, or did you advertise on the radio or in the press?
Yes, I'll come to that later, okay. The press part. They were armed with the biggest machine guns, Lewis guns, rifles, of course, and grenades. And in the event of war, the volunteers had to man all the pillboxes on the beaches, each of which had a machine gun. The personnel earmarked for a battery of artillery went to one of the forts in Hong Kong and manned the guns there. Now, each pillbox which these people had to man had a machine gun. Well, I knew personally, having helped in the sighting of the things, that they were a complete, absolute death trap for anyone who entered them. And because the Japanese knew exactly where everyone was. Well, as the event turned out, I wasn't there, of course, but as the event turned out, the Japs didn't attack any of the beaches in which there were pillboxes. Instead of that, they did the most unusual thing and came through the harbour area, which was full of junks, all sorts of shipping, and landed on the north of the island. It took the garrison by surprise, for the simple reason it was the place they least expected it, because it was very difficult. The only advantage they had, it was very difficult for those on shore to realize which were Jap vessels coming through the midst of the junks and other shipping, and which weren't. So a lot of them got ashore unmolested, and were very soon inland. But that's beyond the period I've got to talk about. Now, every year, they had a very large King's Birthday Parade on Happy Valley Racecourse. The whole garrison turned out. The Hong Kong volunteers turned out, and the naval volunteers turned out. The sloop was taken always by His Excellency the Governor. After the parade, on more than one occasion, the Governor used to come up to volunteer headquarters and thank those who'd taken part in it for what they had done, and had a talk to some of the officers. And the same way with Headquarters China Command, the G1 was one of the most helpful people I met for a long time. He was terribly interested in the volunteer movement. He came down to headquarters many nights when they were training, watched the training, and he used to come into the officers' mess about two or three times a week at least and speak to the officers. And he's a very popular man. He was the famous English Rugger International called Harrison. In other words, he went by the name of Dreadnought Harrison. Now, nothing much happened in 1937 except the great typhoon, which I've already described. But in that year, I was given 14 days leave by the government. And on the advice of my friends in Hong Kong, I booked in to Tsing Tao. Well, it was the most unfortunate holiday and the most miserable holiday I've ever spent in my life. I got there, after one night in Shanghai, I got to Tsing Tao, and on entering the hotel, I found it full of German officers, with a lot of hangers-on, Japanese round about. A lot of the German officers speak English, but the Japanese couldn't, so I never had any contact with them at all. But I did try to speak to the Germans. But every time I made any attempt to speak, I was rebuffed. They just take no notice of me. Then I asked a couple of them to have a drink one day, and they pretended not to notice. Just turned away and changed the conversation. And well, I got fed up with this in the end. So I was having a miserable existence. So I decided a couple of days later to get a private car and see something of the country. Now, what annoyed me in a way was all these Germans knew exactly what I was going to do, because you couldn't say a word in that hotel before it came to their knowledge. There were some stewards that passed everything on I said to them, and they knew I was going out in the country. They didn't warn me of the dangers, and they just let me go. Well, I went with a Chinese driver, and we'd gone about 10 miles, and we were stopped by a Japanese patrol. They carefully examined our passport, and by this time, the Chinese driver was getting a bit jittery. How about they let us go on? And I hoped that was the end of it. But another 2 miles on, the same thing happened. And by this time, the driver wasn't worried. He wouldn't go any further. He just turned around to me and said, "Master, this is no bond. Me go home." And I rather agreed with him for the simple reason the last thing I wanted to do was to get involved in some incident that might involve political consequences. So I thought it was the wisest thing to do was to turn around and go straight back home, back to the hotel. Well, when I got to the hotel, I heard a lot of talking going on in the lounge. I opened the door, walked in, and there was dead silence. No one at all. The oldest looked at me. They knew who I was, of course, because the hotel had told them. And the whole thing became so depressing that I decided there and then the sooner I got out of Tsing Tao, the better. So I rang up the shipping company and said, "When can you give me a berth back to Shanghai?" And they said, "There's a terrific exodus going on at present from the north, and all our berths are booked up for the next 3 or 4 days. I said, "I want to get out tonight or tomorrow." And they said, "Well, all we can do for you is give you a deck chair on the deck, and we can provide you with blankets." But as it was only, the journey only involved one night at sea, I decided to do this because the weather was warm, and I took it. And the next morning I left about 9 o'clock for Shanghai.
Why do you think the Germans wouldn't talk to you?
Well, I got the conclusion there was kind of some kind of conspiracy going on. That's what it looked like to me.
Had anyone else from Hong Kong had the same experience or a similar experience?
I think they had, but they weren't saying so. And I'm talking about the higher command.
And you said there was a terrific exodus going on from the north. Who was involved in this exodus?
Well, it was the Jap War on Manchuria. That was bringing many people out of Manchuria in the north down to Shanghai and Hong Kong.
Mainly Europeans, or Europeans and Chinese?
principally European, but there were Chinese amongst them. But the whole atmosphere was conspiratorial, you might say, just exactly like some kind of conspiracy. That was the time that I came to the conclusion, after I got back and thinking it over, that war against Germany was becoming absolutely inevitable. I wasn't allowed to say anything in public about it. But when I got back to Shanghai, first of all, I reported to the general in charge of the troops in Shanghai. It was an old friend of mine, General Telford Smollett. He was very interested, and he said, "Leave the rest to me here. I'll tell the Shanghai volunteers and all the rest of the people got to know, and I'll try and get some of the volunteers who can always be in mufti and go where they want to visit Tsingtao and give me some news." But he said, "When you go back to Hong Kong, please report straight away to the China command." Well, I did. He also suggested I should see the colonial secretary. But I saw the G1. He was interested, but I got the impression that he knew all about it. And he said, "Don't worry with seeing the colonial secretary. The general will be seeing the governor and will speak to him about it and give you a report to him." And that's the last I heard of the incident.
So you got the feeling there were other sources of intelligence apart from members of the Shanghai Corps in mufti wandering around.
Mm.
Yes. How long did you spend when you got back to Hong Kong? How long were you in Hong Kong for?
When I got back?
Mm.
Well, I got back in the end of 37. Well, 1938 was my last year in command of the volunteers. My time expired in September. And in that year, we had a big annual dinner for the whole corps, attended by the governor, the GOC, G1, the commodore, the naval volunteers, and a lot of the Taipans, many of whom were members of the Legislative Assembly. My duty on that occasion was to give an account of the events of what the Corps had been doing for the last 12 months. But before I was allowed to speak, I had to take what I was going to say up to Government House and let the governor vet it. I suppose he thought, in order to make certain I wasn't going to tread on forbidden ground. But also, I think, he wanted to see what I was going to say so that he could frame his speech accordingly. Now, we had a very good press in those days. Both the governor's speech and my speech were given to the press two or three days before the dinner. And the morning after the dinner, his speech and my speech occupied the headlines of most of the morning newspapers. And they gave a really big, they gave me, Tenbrand, a very big send-off with that party.
I don't think you mentioned how you came to be promoted from adjutant to commander of the...
Oh, yes, well, it was... another thing I've got to tell you was 6 months after I got there, we formed a fifth company. It was a Chinese company. It recruited very well, and there were a very good body of men. About that same time, it was decided that the Corps should be commanded by a regular officer. China Command selected me, put it up to War Office, and the War Office agreed. And I was appointed Commandant of the Corps with the local rank of Lieutenant Colonel. That was in 1936.
What was the general feeling like among the Hong Kong Volunteer Corps? Was it did they take things very seriously?
That was one thing that affected recruiting as regards to the British community were concerned, because the civil population were what I call very apathetic. You can never drill into their minds that there's any chance of war. They wouldn't listen to you. Well, that was the same in Singapore and the same throughout the Far East.
Did you have any liaison with, say, the Shanghai Volunteer Corps? Hmm? Did you have any contact with the Shanghai Volunteer Corps?
I did personally, because I knew their commander, and we corresponded. And we sort of settled problems together, if there were any. But I got on very well with them.
What sort of problems did you settle together?
I can't really remember now. But we talked a lot. And of course, during the year I spent in Hong Kong, I was in close contact with them.
Can you...
Shanghai.
Yes. Can you describe the manoeuvres, the joint manoeuvres you did with the Navy and the regular forces in Hong Kong?
Yes. Well, the Navy were to select a place to land. No one else knew where it was going to be on the island, or the mainland, anywhere. And the job of the Hong Kong garrison and the volunteers was A, to find out where it was going to be, and B, to oppose it.
And how did they pass off the maneuvers?
Well, there were two of them. The second one, the first one, they attacked the island. Well,
yes, you were telling me about the first exercise.
About the...
The first...
Yes, well, that was easy. That but the second one was rather more difficult. They chose to land on the mainland, and most of the garrison and practically all the volunteers, except the armored cars, and those in pillboxes, were on the island. Well, it took a long time to spot them. And I think it was about 3 o'clock in the second afternoon that we found out where they were. And the exercise went on much longer than was anticipated. The bankers were getting worried because they couldn't get their personnel back. I was getting worried because I'd promised them they would be back, and China Command were getting worried with me for worrying them.
So, when did you finally leave Hong Kong?
I left Hong Kong in October 38. And the great tragedy then was, it must have been fairly obvious to most people that there was going to be war, but what saved the situation to start with was Hong Kong was not involved in any way with the war against Germany. So there was a 2-year gap between the German and our war with Germany and the Japanese attack on Hong Kong. But it's almost incredible to think that nothing would ever induce the civil population, even at the last moment, to realize any chance of war. On the day war broke out, on the day the Japs invaded Hong Kong, the same night, they were dancing and dining in all the big restaurants. Messages had to be sent round all the place, summoning service officers back to their units. By this time, shells were falling on the island.
Do you think Hong Kong could have been defended?
No, but I think there was a simple reason. they imported a lot of untrained troops. I mean, with a very willing, very good Canadian brigade. Well, they were entirely untrained. They didn't know the island, and it was essential to know your way about. The attack started too soon. I personally always thought Hong Kong was indefensible, and I much rather personally have seen the whole of the Hong Kong garrison sent to Singapore. The only advantage in holding on to Hong Kong, it gave Singapore time to get ready. But they didn't take that advantage of that, and they weren't ready when the time came, just the same as Hong Kong weren't.
Thank you very much.